Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Episode 3 of the PFRA podcast, the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast. John Bozica, George Bozica, along with you. Episode 1, we talked to Mark Miller, former Browns quarterback. Episode 2, we talked to historian in Dennis Crawford. And episode 3 now tonight, we have another great guest coming up, or whenever you're listening to this. I always say tonight because we record these at night, but whenever you're listening to it, it's probably not during the night. We hope it's on the way to work, wherever it may be. And wherever you're listening to it, please make sure you give us a rating. Follow us if you're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to this. Give us a rating. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. Subscribe. And as I said before, George and I will do our best to try to take those notes and give you guys, the listeners, exactly what it is that you're asking for. George, episode 3 tonight. Excited about this. I think we've had 2 good episodes so far, a lot of good content. I think we're slowly building this. We've got some things in the works coming down the line in a bit here. We're going to talk to some players, some more of those coming up, but kind of a different story tonight.
Yeah, tonight our guest is Greg Fisseri. Greg recently released a book called Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. And this is a book that Greg researched for a number of years. It was a labor of love for him. And without, I guess, giving away what the book is about, it's a beautifully put together book, a coffee table book with a great story and also some great photographs and great illustrations about a story that has a personal touch for him about the very early days of pro football, pre-NFL.
The Maslin Tigers, correct?
That is part of the story, yes. Yeah. The original Maslin Tigers pro football team.
Right.
For listeners that are obviously in the Stark County area, when they hear Maslin Tigers, they think of the high school dynasty, the Maslin Tigers. But this is the original
I thought pro. All those titles were mythical.
Yeah.
No, I'm joking with you.
This is the original pro Maslin Tigers. Which actually has a tie to the high school team, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Right. Great. And it's interesting too, because, you know, anytime you associate anything with Maslin, as I jest about the history of the Tigers, you know, there is such a long line and a lineage throughout the town of history. And in this book, you know, obviously relates to the pro team. But fans there, anything that is Tiger related, they kind of put under their purview of like, well, that's Maslin, you know, and it's like the town has that orange and black pride about everything. So even though it was the pro team, lots of the people there, including some of the historians of the team, have helped him put some things together in this. So I know we're going to hear some of those stories tonight, and that's going to be exciting. And Greg will be joining us when we come back. Joined now by Greg Fisseri, who we mentioned earlier in the opening, and an author of a book that has recently come out, a great coffee table book. And Greg, thanks for joining us, George and I, and thanks for being part of the podcast.
Thanks for having me, and congrats on the new PFRA podcast. It's exciting.
Absolutely. It's been fun so far. So tell us about the book. We've obviously already given the title out, but tell us about it. You can give the title again. You can tell us where it kind of started, where the inspiration came from to put this together, because it really is a beautiful book. I mean, we have a copy sitting right in front of us right now as we're recording this. And, you know, tell us about that, what went into it, and kind of the process and where you came up with the name and so on and so forth.
Well, thanks for your support. Glad you have one, and to appreciate the detail of it. So The inspiration for Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's missing origin story, as it came to be known, was my great-grandfather, Bob Shiring, who I knew growing up as a young boy in Pittsburgh, in the suburb, eastern suburb of Pittsburgh called Wilmerding, which is about 10 miles from downtown, part of the Monongahela Valley, sort of the Westinghouse air brake community, very old industrial area where my grandmother lived. She had three photos, large framed photos, probably 24 by 36, something like that, 18 by 24, not sure, including the frame, but of these, two of which were clearly labeled the Massillon Tigers from 1905 and 1906. And one was unidentified, but had an H on a few of the sweaters. And it took me decades, you know, until I became an adult to figure out that that was the Homestead Library and Athletic Club, which is about 5 miles east of Pittsburgh and a steel community. Homestead Steel became Carnegie Steel, became U.S. Steel eventually. So my great-grandfather played for that 1901 World Championship Homestead team with bunches of Ivy League All-Americans, just the, some of the best professionals of that time. And he, however, only had actually an eighth grade education, didn't even go to high school, but like some in the area, just picked up football and started playing some local, you know, club teams and eventually some really good amateur teams, including the James F. Lallis Athletic Club, which was the state, you know, amateur champion. And I guess from playing Homestead, since pros played amateur teams, he became, he was recruited to join the Homestead team. So the more I learned about him and his career, basically being the best center of the pre-NFL era, I just always wanted to know more and kept digging and digging and sort of went from there.
Well, and you mentioned that, you mentioned the pre-NFL era, and obviously those were the days where, you know, teams were kind of just put together on a whim, you know, and things happen and then they came and they went, and sometimes seasons happened as quickly as teams folded. So it was quite a time to play professional football. Tell me kind of what the story then is, as people are starting to look at the book. What is the story that they're going to hear if they're going to get into the book? And then we'll get into some more of the details that we have, because I know George has a lot of questions about that. But if people are going to leaf through this, what are they going to see?
Well, the biggest question, you know, in sort of the heart and theme of the book was an unsolved cold case of an alleged gambling scandal that happened in the 1906 season between the Massillon Tigers and Canton Bulldogs, which were the two best teams in the country, pro teams at the time. So wanting to tell that story, if I could, and combine it with the photos that I inherited from my great-grandfather's career into a really special book. I mean, a couple of things that nobody had, those photos and that actually solving that case by finding a court file in Ohio, in Stark County, that had the depositions from a case that never got to trial, created the opportunity to do the book. So then the question became, where does the book start? How does it start? You know, how far do I go back? And it just seemed like to do the whole history of football justice, I had to connect the dots from the beginning. So there are a few pages just about the origins of ball games, you know, in Europe in the Middle Ages, just kind of fun stuff. And then how it evolved to soccer and rugby, and then American football shortly, you know, after the Civil War. So after a brief introduction, we get into the birth of pro football, and initially in the Pittsburgh area, and then how it transitioned to Ohio and into the drama of the scandal and its resolution. So that's sort of the arc of the book.
I thought it was interesting when I was looking through the book and reading it in preparation that you said two of your sort of mentors when you decided you were going to start this quest were Bob Carroll and Joe Horrigan. Can you go into that?
Right. So my grandmother passed away in 2007. And when we cleaned out her home in Wilmerding, I found another huge box of photos, you know, from his football career, Bob Schiering's career. And I instantly knew that they were special and, you know, not just the typical team photos either, like some rare, like buddy type pictures, small group pictures, action pictures, individuals that I didn't recognize. So some were named on the back and others weren't. So I wanted to find out more about them at first. And that's when, you know, to get some help, I went online and found the PFRA for the first time. And Bob Carroll was still with us, and he was reachable in, I guess, North Huntington, Pennsylvania, where he lived near Pittsburgh. And he was very helpful. He wasn't in great health at the time, but he was still passionate about pro football and very, you know, passionate about what I would had found. And asked if I would send him copies of the pictures. And so we had some fun for a couple months, you know, communicating about them. And he helped me identify them all and then pointed me to Joe Horrigan at the Hall of Fame. And having said that he and Joe worked together at in the earliest days of the PFRA, I think starting in 1979. And he said each of them took a year, you know, and wrote an article about 1 year back and forth and back and forth. And that's how all those great articles were, you know, put on the PFRA's website. And I still think, you know, some of the best research, if not the best from that period, available. So they both, you know, recognized how unique and special the photos were and encouraged me to keep going. And that there was this sort of still unresolved pace to explore, to add to the photos.
Yeah, you know, one thing I was reminded of when I read the book is there's an old Western movie that came out, the John Ford director with Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne, called The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And at the end of the movie, Jimmy Stewart is talking to a reporter. And Jimmy Stewart has just told the story of the man who shot Liberty Valance. And it wasn't as they thought the story was. And the reporter says to him, he says, "When the legend becomes fact, print the legend." I was taken by that because your book did the exact opposite. Instead of talking about the legend, you basically found some interesting facts through your quest and through your research, and you've told the facts. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that came to mind was your research on the first forward pass.
Greg, you didn't think you'd get a movie lesson too about the man who shot Liberty Valance, did you? He's good for more than just football. Go ahead.
Another one from my list.
I guess so. So about the forward pass, go ahead.
The forward pass, yeah, it was an aside, really, and another one of many rabbit holes that I ended up going down as I was writing the story. So really cool how it came to pass that one of my many visits to Massillon, the wonderful people in Massillon in the community, as my network there grew, I was introduced to the folks at the Massillon Booster Club. And these are sort of the old guard and the keepers of the flame of the Massillon memorabilia in
little great folks
museum. Yeah. And Gene Berner was the head of it at the time, who's no longer with us, but and some others, Gary Vogt, I remember, was in the room, and Ron Prunty, who's still with us, the videographer from Massillon, who does all the games.
Love so, Ron.
He what a great guy. And so we all came together in this old middle school, which was abandoned, and they used for their museum, you know, their storage basically. And as I explained to them, I think Margie Vogt, not related to Gary, introduced me to them. And as I was telling them the story of what I was trying to accomplish, Ron lit up and brought out these old laminated 1906 newspapers from the Maslin paper and the Maslin Gleaner. And so what he had recognized when he found them, and he explained that he discovered them there when they moved into that building, that they were just left there for some reason. I mean, that's amazing how that could be possible. But he just asked if whoever rented them the building, if he could have them, and they agreed. So laminated them with foresight. And so he brought out these 1906 daily papers that had never been digitized, even in the Maslin Library or the Ohio Library in Columbus. Only the weekend papers had been put on microfilm. So obviously the games took place on the weekends. And then, so the game stories came out during the week. And so this was the first time the details of the games were available. And Ron was good enough. I couldn't read them all at the time. He made copies of them and sent me them in actual size in a tube. And I just put them away for a few years until I got into, down the road in the story, writing it to the 1906. And I started going through the papers day by day to see what was relevant. And boom, there it was, in the headline, as clear as day, Tigers throw the first forward pass. And I'm like, and it was successful, went for two touchdowns the legend has it, in the Hall of Fame and everything, that Peggy Parrott was the guy who'd thrown the first forward pass and was for the Maslin Tigers. But no, it was not Peggy Parrott. It was Charlie Moran. And I'm like, wait a minute. He said Moran threw the pass to Parrott. And I'm like, so I had to go back and look at the stories again. And first of all, ask myself, what date was this? So it was actually 2 weeks before Parrott had allegedly thrown the first forward pass. And it turned out that while Parrott had started the season as quarterback, they lost one of their players, a tight end, to Canton. And so Parrott had to fill in at end, and Moran could play quarterback, and they shuffled around, and that they didn't throw a pass in the first game of the season, but the second game, that's when it happened. So as clear as day, Moran, threw the first forward pass. And so I wrote an article for the PFRA to update the history last year or so.
What was it like knowing, because I mean, we obviously talked in the open too, that this for you, not just a research project, but truly, as George put it, a labor of love, because it involves a family member from yesteryear. But what's it like to know that Bob, somebody in your bloodline, had an influence on that, had an influence on such a ginormous moment in the game that we know today, where, the forward pass back then was looked at something as being like, it's like, well, what did they just do? And now it's like, if you don't throw at least 30 passes a game, you're going to lose the NFL game that you're playing in. So it's like, what's it like to know that Bob Schiering, someone in your bloodline, your great grandfather, what's it like to know that he was there in that moment and was part of that huddle, part of that moment when that took place?
Right. And as the captain of the team, by the way.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. It's a little footnote, he snapped the ball for the first forward pass, right?
That's a huge deal, though. I mean, it's what we always say, the play can't start without the center. I mean, that's got to be such a crazy thing to know that your grandfather was the first person to touch the ball on the forced forward pass. That's huge. Your great grandfather,
great grandfather, right? Thanks. It's fun to me, but much bigger to me was knowing that he became the captain. Something about his character made him worthy of being voted or elected the captain of this best team in the country, surrounded by all these Ivy League All-Americans, well-educated, players who went on to become great politicians, attorney, whatever, in the country, and that they saw his character as being worthy to be their leader, I think means a lot more to me than that. And as just sort of, as the patriarch of our family, I think is was very satisfying.
which takes us to the 2006 or 1906 season, I should say, 2006.
Yeah.
And that's basically the heart of the book, is the 1906 season. As you said, you were on this quest to finish the story in regard to that, because there had been a story for years that involved, obviously, the Bulldogs and the Tigers. Names that season, and I think most historians had heard of the name Blondie Wallace and the gambling scandal, but you wanted to get to the bottom of it because you felt that the whole story had not been told. You know that your great-grandfather played a role in that, and actually was and I'll let you tell the story, was actually one of the good guys. If you can elaborate on, you know, that quest. You mentioned obviously that you found a case file in Stark County. I remember talking to you when you were doing some research on that. And I remember you mentioning to me, you're trying to find this case file because you feel that this is going to answer some of the questions that you wanted. So tell us about that, because I think that will be interesting to researchers that listen to, is what you had to go through to find that case file. And then the whole thing, because I thought it was just fascinating to read the depositions in the book that you found and some of the other things that came to light with that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, of all the family lore, the little nuggets that my grandmother would share, you know, repeatedly when I was young, the most, I think she was the most proud of, was that his integrity in it being known that he was one of the good guys, that there was some sort of bribe offered to him as the captain of the team to lose the championship game on purpose, or series of games, to some sort of fix whatever, you know, the plan was. Wasn't clear to me at the time, but that he reported it to his coach, and the coach ended up reporting it to the team management, and they tried, you know, in some harebrained way, as it turned out, to defuse it all, and it really ended up blowing up on all of them, and eventually the E.J. Stewart, who was the team's manager and initial amateur quarterback, and also the sports editor of the Massillon Gleaner newspaper. So he was very, you know, biased, obviously, and really created the rivalry more than anybody else by dramatizing the negotiations with Blondie Wallace leading up to the championship game, and creating angst between the teams, and really bitterness with Blondie Wallace along the way. And then after the two games that the team split, the two games, the people suspected, rumors were spreading that the games were fixed so that there could be a third game. And a fight broke out in the Cortland Hotel in Canton when somebody stood up and screamed, "These games were fixed." And the players were in the bar after the game, having lost the second game to Massillon, in no mood for that, said no, they weren't. And a fight broke out. Somebody went through the glass window, just like in a Burt Reynolds movie, and people wanted answers. So E.J. Stewart's response was to write a full page, front page article in the Massillon Gleaner the next day, denying that the games were fixed. However, admitting finally that there was an attempted bribe by one of their own players, who they released, a fellow named Walter East. And East actually admitted to, you know, being connected to gamblers who provided the money for this. But when the paper and E.J. Stewart went a step too far and accused Blondie Wallace of colluding in the scheme, and Wallace denied it, and East even absolved him in the newspaper of complicity, that's what really blew everything up. And Blondie Wallace sued the newspaper and the team and for libel, and ultimately couldn't absolve himself because he, at least officially, ran out of money to continue fighting, you know, the case. So it went down in history unknown as to whether he was involved or not, and he could never clear his name. So he was sort of the shoeless Joe Jackson of football in many ways.
And yeah,
I was just going to say that. I mean, it says, and I guess that's the thing I was going to ask. I mean, knowing the story of Eight Men Out about the Black Sox scandal, and I think that was 1919, right? I had to look at my dad for a second there to see, because I know that he knows that. But
he was there, actually.
He was, just like everything else. He was there when they shot Liberty Valance as well. Let's think about that for a second. Your great grandfather, Bob Schiering. I mean, did you know him? Did you ever meet him, Greg?
No, he passed away, and I think about 7 years before I was born. Yeah.
So I guess this was also a chance for you to get to know the man too, and knowing that your great grandfather was kind of the Shoeless Joe Jackson of professional football in its infancy. What else did you learn about Bob Schiering, the man, that maybe you didn't know about his life after football, his life during football, his marriages, whatever it may have been? What did you learn about him that you didn't know that tied to some of his football stuff?
So beyond the football history, which I think is fascinating enough for many people, for some people that don't aren't as interested in football, many people love just the morality play involved here. It could be any subject, but their the background drop happens to be football, and a lot of people love a cold case or a backstory or just the beauty of the photo, the vintage photos. But the it's really the dichotomy, you know, of Wallace really being the Shoeless Joe Jackson, perhaps falsely accused of a crime, more or less fraud, versus and what the consequences of just those allegations did to his life. You know, he became he was blackballed out of football, and despite being an icon essentially of that era, an All-American at Penn and a national champion and a real pioneer of the game in starting the first pro team in Philadelphia before, you know, and getting Connie Mack on board from the baseball Philadelphia A's to invest and help with that. And then taking his show to Canton, being recruited to go out and run the team over there, and taking the full responsibility, financial responsibility for that team in the 1906, which nobody had done before other than like industrial, you know, wealthy people. He took all the risk. So, an incredible person in pioneer in many ways, whose life then became, you know, devolved into a life of crime. And the question, was it really nature or nurture for him? You know, was he a bad guy who just did one bad thing after the next and ended up being one of the biggest bootleggers in the country in his home and in New Jersey afterward, and end up being chased by the FBI and the feds and going to jail? Or was it because he you know, was falsely accused and didn't have any other answers, you know, for a career, not even having graduated from Penn because he didn't make the grades there to finish, you know, do his senior year. So, and a really fascinating character versus Bob Schiering, who by all accounts was almost too good to be true. I could see some people reading this and say, oh, he's just, you know, just making his grandfather to be great grandfather to be this perfect guy, but he almost was, you know, the underdog, sort of without much education, rising to this peak of his career and a captain of a world championship team, and then while being first suspected of perhaps colluding in this scheme, since he was offered the bribe, it quickly came out that he had reported it and had done the right thing. But after that whole situation, being able to go back to Pittsburgh and sort of leveraging his career to become a very prominent financial services entrepreneur and business owner, sort of being the guru of the little town of Wilmerding with taxes and insurance and real estate, and for serving his community as the justice of the peace and the head of the Schiering agency, which still exists today, believe it or not, in that little town, although it's outside of the family. But there's just life lessons there of what, you know, down the road, doing the right things led to a good outcome for him. And Blondie, you know, wasn't able to make good in his life, basically. If he could somehow be redeemed from, you know, beyond the grave, and it would be, you know, without too much of a spoiler alert, that's where, you know, it would be justice. The wheels of justice could end up turning very slowly.
Well, at least they're going to turn. You know, it's interesting because obviously your great grandfather was a man of integrity. I know that one of the co-players too that you mentioned in the book is Tiny Maxwell, who was also offered the bribe, and he turned it down too. By the way, Tiny Maxwell was by no means tiny based on the pictures, but I always get a kick out of the nicknames from those days. But you know, Blondie Wallace was basically sort of demonized, and you know, not to spoil the story, but I think people will be pleasantly surprised to find what you did when you got a chance to look at that that case file. You know, one thing that's interesting too is this scandal almost killed pro football. It took a while for it to come back. I mean, everybody knows, you know, growing up in Canton, as I did, you know, we always knew the story of the NFL Canton Bulldogs, and we always knew the story of Jim Thorpe and stuff like that. I don't remember as a kid ever hearing the name Blondie Wallace. It wasn't until I became a researcher that I started hearing about the name Blondie Wallace and some of those things. But, you know, there was a period, sort of a dead period for pro football after that 1906 season, if you can go into that.
Right. So it is another fun fact that the wonderful rivalry between today's Massillon Tigers and Canton Bulldogs in Stark County and in Ohio at the high school level, which I've had the wonderful pleasure, you know, to participate in as a spectator three times now. I just love coming up for those games.
Well, next year when you come, Greg, because I hope you would come, let us know and we'll grab breakfast with you beforehand, because absolutely. We'd love to go to the game with you. That'd be a blast. Go ahead, though. Keep telling the story.
You'll have to join more than 20 of my family. We had 23 friends and family at the game this year. It's become our family reunion. We started a reunion again.
It brings people together. Go ahead with the story, though, what you were saying.
For sure. So the war since 1894, as they say, they've been playing at the high school level somehow even before the pro teams, but they weren't called the Tigers and the Bulldogs until the pro teams were established. I can't say for sure, but to your point about why the story of the pre-NFL era was basically lost or so little known, seems to me is because of this scandal, most likely, that people didn't want to remember the dark period, or, you know, seemingly dark period that happened, and have that be their origin story. They would prefer to forget it. And the people, the fans that supported, started supporting the game up, you know, in Ohio from 1903 to 06 after the 10-year Pittsburgh period from 1892 to 1902, sort of gave up on it, thought it was corrupt and, you know, not trustworthy, so didn't support it. And it took about 10 years to get over that until some folks in Canton, namely the Jack Cusack, who gets credit for having been like an equipment kid or ball boy, basically, when he was about 16 for the Canton pro team in 1906, loved it so much, was even in the bar in the Cortland Hotel when that fight broke out, despite being 16. And somebody asked him if he would be interested in, you know, restarting, try V2 of the Canton pro team. And he said it was the most fun he ever had in his life, and he would love to do that. So it was his idea to recruit Jim Thorpe to come and play for the new Bulldogs, and thinking that would bring people back out. And it did, for sure. They had huge crowds by those days standards. 10,000 and more people would come to see Jim Thorpe play. And then Newt Rockne followed a couple short years later, and they would play against each other. Matt Rockne for Maslin and Thor for Canton. So 1915 to 1919 or so, the game grows. All of a sudden, there's 14 professional teams or so around the, not just Ohio, but surrounding states. And as you know, the owners got together in the Ralph Hayes Hutmobile in Canton and formed, first called the American Pro Football Association in 1920, which shortly 2 years later became known as the NFL. So yeah, it was, but the pioneers, you know, the founders' story was gone, and they deserve, it deserves to be known, and they deserve to be honored. And ultimately, hopefully, the Hall of Fame picks up on it.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting in the book, you mentioned that a question that you asked directly to Joe Horrigan was, given the fact that your great grandfather was probably the greatest center of that era, shouldn't he be in the Hall of Fame?
I was just going to ask that. Do you think Bob Schiering should have a bust in the Hall of Fame?
Honestly, yes. Not just him, but I think if not busts, for there's a group of those pioneers who should be have an exhibit, you know, significant exhibit devoted to them. And so Joe and I had that conversation when I first visited the Hall of Fame in 2012 with my mother, actually, and I suggested that maybe that was the purpose of my whole quest, you know, on sort of the calling that I had to have these men honored as such. And at the time, he very, you know, clearly and directly said that, you know, that would not happen, because it was the policy of the Hall of Fame not to include players from the pre-NFL era, which was a little disappointing, you know, a little let down after, you know, at the end of that journey, it seemed. But he said not that this is the NFL Hall of Fame, it's the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And yes, he was the greatest center of the period, but they look at it like there's probably 20, you know, or so people, players worthy of that honor, and they just don't have enough information, or didn't at the time, to select them and differentiate them. So fortunately, you know, except now almost 10 years later, when Joe spoke at the PFRA conference in Canton last year, he had a much different take on it, and was much more encouraging that something could happen, and that they should definitely be honored in some way. So looking forward to seeing how that might develop.
I recall that. And I think you even mentioned in the book that you felt like the door might be ajar a little bit in regard to that. And I think that's hopeful.
I'm looking at the book right now, and I'm going to stick it up, and we don't put video out of this, but I'm going to show you that I have it in my hand, but I do have it in my hand. I want to know, is your great grandfather on the front cover here? Like, if I'm looking at this, where can I find Bob Schiering in this very black and white photo of players that I'm looking at right here? Which one is him?
Well, he is front and center holding the ball, which was the honor bestowed upon the captain.
That's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool thing. I was wondering if that was him, that there's the hat right below him. He's clearly wearing what looks like a white shirt. He's got the football in his hands, and obviously not the football that we're so used to seeing today that looks so perfectly put together by Wilson, as many people use it, but a much more, you know, round shaped football. Almost looks like a basketball that he's holding. I was going to ask you about the book too. Obviously it's about the story of your great grandfather, but your foreword in this is by Franco Harris. And Franco just passed recently. What did it mean, and what does it mean to have Franco's words as the foreword to this? And how close did you and Franco become when putting this project together?
Thanks for asking that. It means a lot, and even more now than it did before. Obviously, such a blessing to have his words included for posterity, and his take on the importance of the story, the significance of it, what it meant to him even. A lot of people ask, you know, how did I get to know him? And it, as things developed, when the Senator John Hines History Center opened in Pittsburgh, I can't remember exactly what year, early 2000s, I think it took me several years to get there since I wasn't living in Pittsburgh at the time. But when I finally did, I caught the spirit of the place and the passion for it right away and befriended one of their exhibit associates and did some work together to donate some of my other memorabilia to their exhibits. And eventually, in appreciation of that, they invited me to be on their advisory board, which they called the Champions Committee. And that was 2012. And Franco was the head of that. And so in my first meeting that summer, I'm sitting there next to Franco at the table, watching a video that they put together of the greatest moments in Pittsburgh sports history. And I'm watching the Immaculate Reception while sitting next to Franco. And that was pretty surreal. So when we all introduced ourselves around the table, and I sort of briefly mentioned my project, and he approached me afterward and said how interested he was in it and actually offered to be helpful in any way possible, which was amazing. And I suggested at some point, though I had a lot of work still to do, that it would be great if he would write a foreword for it. And he said he would be glad to, and just let him know and not to worry about the time. And this was one of the many special things he said was, he said, you have something really, you know, timeless here, that it'll be ready when it's supposed to be ready. So I thought that was pretty powerful and sort of God's timing in the whole thing. And, you know, 10 years, maybe at least 5 years, probably about 10 years later, I circled back with him, and he was joking with me. He pretended to forget, you know, our comment. He said, did I say I would do that? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, I'm just kidding. So he asked me to send him the soft copy of it, which he didn't, and give him the weekend to read it. And that's one little more nice story I'll share about his thoughtfulness. He said, call me on Monday, you know, and I did. And he said, you know, I didn't have a chance to obviously to read it all, but I read the beginning, and you're a really good writer. And I said, well, wow, thank you. He said, well, there's one line in particular that stuck out to me. And I said, I bet I know which one it is. And he said, which one? And I mentioned the line about that as athletes, we live for moments when we become more than we thought we could be, basically in our performance. And he said, that's it. And I said, well, of course you had the Immaculate Reception. And he said, no, it wasn't that. And I said, well, sometime in my writing, I said, it could be in front of the whole world, you know, and live forever, or it could be just something personal that nobody else noticed, but you appreciated yourself to that effect. And he said, there was this one play that I would lay in bed thinking about, this one move that I always wanted to do. And it happened one day against the Cowboys. I said, was it in a Super Bowl? He said, no, it's just a regular season game. And I broke through the line, and there was this linebacker named Lewis. And I said, it was D.D. Lewis. He said, yeah, D.D. Lewis. He said, you got it. And he said, I pulled this move, this fake, and spun away from him, and it worked, and I scored. And he said, it's just how I dreamed it up. And he said, I didn't even know if D.D. knew what happened or what I did. And years later, I saw him speak, and he spoke of this play that Franco, this move that Franco put on him one time, and he ended up with his hand inside his face mask.
You know, and, go ahead.
But that was really special to me that I touched. I think just that the intro was about sort of why we're passionate about football sports so much, and that resonated with him and made him willing to write the foreword.
You know, I was gonna say I've interviewed a number of Hall of Famers in my time, and I had the pleasure to speak to Franco for like 2 minutes one time at a camp in Canton, and I asked him, the last question I asked him was, did you catch it? And he just looked at me and he laughed and he said, that's for you to decide. And I saw him
later I was in the bathroom and we were next to each other in the stall, and I just looked at him and he and I just both laughed at each other. And, you know, it's interesting to me that you mentioned the character of your great grandfather, because I think that a modern day guy that a lot of people would say embodies the character of the NFL is a guy like Franco Harris. I mean, did it for a long time, did it the right way, was, you know, the guy that was the image of that steel curtain team offensively, the great running back that he was, and he was such a high character individual. It's got to be cool to know that a Hall of Famer like 32 is the one that spoke that, penned that for you, knowing his character as well, right?
Absolutely. I couldn't think of anybody better. And I did spend a lot of time thinking about who to ask to do that. But he was always number one. And others who gave quotes within the book, Rocky Blyer and Frenchie Fuqua and Merrill Hodge among some of the Steelers, but also Ken Crippen and Andy Masich, the CEO of the Heinz History Center, other historians. But a lot of thought went into that. And you can't get everyone that you want to do it. But after Franco sadly passed recently, I went back and we texted a lot too, just about different things. He was a big tennis fan. I played college tennis and, you know, we just had some fun together. And I sent him some copies of the book when it finally printed this summer. For him to enjoy and some of his friends, and I just checked in with him to see if he got them, and he said he was looking forward to a relaxing Labor Day weekend reading it, and thanked me for letting him be a part of the project, which is just, you know, incredible. You know, not that, I mean, I'm so thankful to him, and anybody would be, but not everybody would just, you know, thank, you know, return the thanks. And so that's pretty special.
I know that one thing that we talked about recently, Greg, is that I know you're trying to take the book a step further and possibly do something in other media, TV or film. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Thanks. Actually, before I even started writing the book myself, I was introduced to a filmmaker named Rick Cohen, who was living in Atlanta at the time, because he had a son in college here. But he had spent many years in LA working on sports media projects and documentaries and films. Nothing, you know, super big or well known, but he was here in Atlanta, and he had a big interest in the story after having read the Sports Illustrated article that also came out in 2012. And all these things seemed to start happening that year. And so he said, yes, I'd seen that, and I'd love to come over and see your collection and talk about this potential for a screenplay or film or a miniseries and documentary. Let's see what makes sense. So he came to our home, and before he left that day, I mean, it just seemed to click. He had also ironically played football at Penn like Blondie Wallace. So he had, it was just too, you know, fortuitous and synchronicity, I guess, in some ways. So it seemed like it was meant to be, basically. And so we started down the path, and he wrote a very interesting, I think wonderful 6-part miniseries that's completely done, currently called Maslin. I think it should be called Canton because people connect Canton more to football, but he likes the, you know, masculinity of Maslin. So we'll see how that works. Whatever network buys it can have the naming rights, I suppose. But it's a little more historical fiction. Had to have a female character or two in there for a interest, but I really like it. So I think however any production company would want to change it, the bones of a really good story are there with a lot of great elements.
You know, you mentioned in passing, I meant to ask about that and we didn't as we're sort of closing up here, but you mentioned the Sports Illustrated article, and there was a Sports Illustrated article called the, I believe, the first Super Bowl.
Correct.
And it was about the Canton-Massa 1906 season. And I think you even had a credit in that article, if I'm not mistaken.
I did. Photo credit. The writer was Richard Hoffer. And he had written for 25 years as a full-time journalist for them. I guess he was semi-retired at the time. And so got to do a longer form project for them. And when he went to the Hall of Fame to start it, I think Salim Chowdhury was helping him with start his research. And Salim just told him, just save your time. Call Greg. He's already done it all. So
there you go.
So he called me up, said, what do you got? You know, how can you help? And I told him all my sources, you know, books and so on. And at the end, I said to him, well, hey, you might want some photos for that article. I have, you know, my great grandfather's collection. And he was like, said, what? He said, nobody has photos from that time. He said, that's really special. He said, of course, we'd like to use a couple. And even maybe in our separate football history coffee table book. And I said, well, glad to let you use some for the article, but I'm going to work on my own book at some point. He said he even thought about doing a novel or something afterward, but he got into some other projects. But speaking of novels, aside from the miniseries that Rick Cohen wrote with my help, another publishing company now wants to have me help as a story advisor on a novel related to the story and really develop all the characters in their own way, which I think will be super fun to sort of brainstorm and whiteboard all of the dialogue that might have happened.
Last thing for you here, Greg, before we let you go, and we thank you so much, Greg Vasari, author of Gridiron Legacy, Pro Football's Missing Origin Story. Author is Greg Vasari, forward by Franco Harris. Thanks to you for being on the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast as part of the Sports History Network. Last thing we want to let you do here is, where can people buy the book? Where can people find you? Do you have Twitter? Do you have Facebook? Do you have, how active are you on the social media platforms? And where can people buy this this great book that's a nice, I guess, compliment to the history of the game?
Yeah. Well, thanks for the chance to plug. I have spent a good bit of time recently changing hats into the marketing and PR aspect of it all, and working with an excellent digital marketing company here in Atlanta. We did a nice Facebook ad campaign before the holidays that was successful. And we're about to start another one any day in the run-up to the Super Bowl. So I have a Gridiron Legacy Facebook page, as well as my personal page. I have a personal Instagram page where I also post a lot of things in, about the book, and on LinkedIn. I don't do Twitter. But the gridironlegacy.com website is currently the only place to buy the book and learn more about it. We put a lot of events and recordings. We'll put this one up there from other podcasts. I did ESPN Radio in Pittsburgh yesterday with Stan Savran, actually, which was
saw that.
Big step.
You had the he's known out there as like the Godfather or something like that. Isn't that his a nickname?
The Power Hour. I don't know what on you know. Things.
Yeah, no, he's a powerful man.
He's a legend.
He is.
Eventually, Greg, Amazon coming this fall. We've got to get them some inventory before they can. It's in listed in pre-sale on Amazon right now.
Okay. Well, Greg, we really appreciate it. I know George and I both do, and it's a great story. It's a great book, and thanks for joining us here.
Thank you so much. Good luck as you move forward with your podcast.
Thanks, Ray.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Hello, football friends. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and I'd like to invite you to the portal of positive football history, Pigskin Dispatch and PigskinDispatch.com. We talk about everything that centers around the game of American football, expert discussions, the origins of the games, the great players, teams, and coaches, and more, as some great guests and insights from experts. We have new episodes 3 to 4 times a week, and you can find us on SportsHistoryNetwork.com, PigskinDispatch.com, or your favorite podcast provider.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.